Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Fantastic, like I say every time.
Every time you're fantastic. Fantastico. Absolutely fantastico. I am doing good.
Well, you just say you're doing great. That way people stop asking questions.
Right?
People, if you say, it sucks, it's like, what's up? Oh, I don't want to talk about it.
You want to make somebody smile when they ask you, hey, how you doing? Groovy.
Groovy.
And they will stop and smile every time. I guarantee it. It has yet to fail me.
Yeah.
How you doing, man? Just groovy.
His smiling position, thinking to themselves, this guy's a
what a
weirdo.
Psycho. What a wackadoodle.
Psycho smile, right? And walk away.
Yeah. Tell him, awesome, and keep on going. Far out, man. Groovy.
Everything is awesome.
Everything is far out. All right. Let's get right into this tonight, shall we?
Let's jump right in.
We got things to do, people to see, places to go. Not really.
And your basement's freezing.
My basement's freezing still. It's like a concrete bunker, so what do you expect?
Is this a recording studio or is this a dungeon?
Yes. You could record in a dungeon.
You could. Oh, the echoes would be
amazing. The screams. The torture chambers.
Exactly.
Unless it's a different kind of dungeon.
Dave's on the rack over there getting stretched out right now.
Right. How's it going, Dave? Great. Let's talk about paddling myths.
Oh, let's talk about that.
There's a lot of myths out there.
There are.
Some of them are hidden myth. Okay, now we can go to the next topic.
That was painful.
I waited for a while to get that one in. Yes, there's lots of myths. Some are true.
There is.
Some are not.
I thought this would be interesting to get into, and I found a lot of resources when it comes to paddling myths, and a lot of great stories of backgrounds of who does what because of this. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting topic, and it kind of ties into the second half of the show. So
kind of, sort of.
Let's dig in.
Let's just get going. Paddling myths often stem from misconceptions about proper technique, equipment, and safety. These myths can lead to frustration, injury, or even accidents. For example, many believe paddling relies solely on arm strength, that inflatable paddleboards are fragile, or that standing in a canoe is inherently dangerous. In reality, good paddling technique involves core rotation. Inflatable paddle boards are surprisingly durable. Furthermore, experienced paddlers often stand in canoes for better visibility. And rolling a kayak, while a valuable skill, is not always necessary for basic paddling. I also stand up in a canoe to get a view, but for canoe poling.
Yes.
Have you ever tried canoe poling sitting down? It doesn't have the same je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same flexibility and ability.
And being a paddler, when I go into my kayak, I use the same simple rule. Keep the top side up.
Yes. Keep the open side up.
Right? Here's a more detailed look at some common paddling myths. Let's start with paddling technique, shall we? Strong arms are essential for paddling. That's the myth.
It is the myth.
The truth, core rotation and body movements are more effective for generating power and efficiency in paddling. It's not just about the arms.
It's not. And anybody who does a lot of paddling knows that your upper arm is really just steering and guiding the paddle blade, and the lower arm is pretty much just pulling back as your body twists. It doesn't take a lot of strength. And really, like, if you're after a long paddling session and stuff, it's your shoulders and core muscles that tend to get sore. Your back, your abdominals, your lats, and so on. So it's your arms can, like, you know, Captain America says, my arms, they tell me I can do this all day.
Right? So just to throw into this, talking about canoe poling, you're thinking when you're canoe poling, your arms pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from experience, feet
both Yeah.
Shins.
Yep.
And your core.
Exactly. The shins from barking off the thwarts.
Yeah. Yes. But the feet, like, it's surprising how sore the feet get.
And I found the same thing. It's, I imagine people who have a depth of experience say, well, no, I don't get sore. Well, if you're starting out, you do, because yeah. you're using a bunch of muscles you're not used to using, and you're using them probably wrong.
Right.
Found the same thing with stand-up paddleboarding. When we went out with Warren and we did that stand-up paddleboarding session, it was my arches of my feet were just cramping up.
So right.
Because I was working too hard at it. I wasn't relaxed. I didn't have the balance down pat.
It was also November, and we were freezing our butts off.
Yes.
But that had nothing to do with it. But no, like, when you're canoe poling, standing there, and you plant that pole,
yeah.
you're sort of using your feet, leg, and core to twist the boat.
Yes.
So your feet are twisting, and
yeah
there's those you never use those muscles paddling.
No, not typically, exactly. Right?
Unless you're walking with a portage load, but other than that.
You might use them while dancing, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. But yeah, so yeah, it's more than just strong arms
mm-hmm.
when you're doing this. Another myth, you must pull the paddle through the water to move forward. Truth, plant the paddle, rotate your body around it, and let the boat move past the
there
paddle.
There you go. The paddle will naturally move through the water, but the ideal is not to move the paddle through the water. It's to plant the paddle and use the water as an anchor point and push the canoe past it.
Right? Myth. Using a cupped paddle blade is superior.
Have you ever tried one?
No.
I have. They're not all they're cut out to be.
Truth. While some prefer a cupped blade, a straight blade can be just as effective and may be easier to learn.
I've used a cup blade before, and I find it very fluttery in the water. Because
mm-hmm.
it'll ship water different directions.
If it's not exactly straight.
Exactly.
Right?
So if you're not using it right, or if you don't know the technique, if you're a beginner with a cup blade, then it feels weird and you don't like it. And I ended up turning it around and putting the non-cupped end using that end to paddle with, because it's like, wow, I'm never going to use this again.
Like the convex side as opposed to the concave side.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's amazing how there's really not, except for the actual shape of a blade, there's really not a ton of difference in.
No, there's not.
The face of.
I've been meaning to. So, Peter Frank.
He's got that one.
He's got one, but as he said, it's designed to imitate the flukes on a whale or whatever, right? So it's different shaped. It's supposed to grab water better.
Whatever.
So I'm curious to talk to him about how that worked out, because I've never seen him talk about it when he posts his daily updates.
Maybe there's a reason.
Yeah, maybe. I'm curious. Yeah. I have seen that he changes his sail a lot, but I've never seen really what he's doing with his paddle.
Mm. Yeah, weird. You figured there'd be. Or maybe the ideas of how to make that the face of that paddle better has always turned into worse. And maybe the original paddle is the best.
Maybe.
Right?
Because the different styles out there, there's the otter tail, the Algonquin, if you're doing white water, you have a big flat platter of flatness. And that's because you need to pull water or break really quickly. But otherwise, the smoother and smaller the blade face, it's like all day paddling, with minimal exertion and exhaustion.
Yeah, otter tail, beaver tail, those are my two go tos.
Mm-hmm.
But even when it comes to kayak paddles, there's not a ton of difference. You got the Greenland paddle,
And
then you got the recreational paddle.
The recreational paddle it's a bit of a curve to it, semi cup, but you're not doing a lot of fancy stuff really with one of those kayak recreational kayak blades, right?
Yeah, fancy.
Hmm.
Paddleboarding myth: inflatable paddleboards are fragile and easily damaged. May have been true when it first started.
Maybe.
But the truth is, inflatable paddle boards are surprisingly durable and can withstand impacts and drops better than hard boards and in some situations, though they should still be protected from sharp objects.
Yeah, you don't need them deflating on you.
Well, and you get some of these harder boards that if you were to drop them on concrete,
yeah,
you might get a nice dent.
Mm-hmm.
But the inflatable is not going to dent.
It just bounce off like a basketball.
Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, when they first came out and we saw them, they were sort of like, oh, I wouldn't want to be taking that down a river or somewhere. One good rock and boom, all of a sudden you're swimming with a big piece of plastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The myth, you need to be super strong to paddleboard. The truth. Paddleboarding relies more on technique and balance than sheer strength. Stronger paddlers will have an advantage, but it is accessible to people of all shapes and sizes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And that's the key thing with paddleboarding. It's more technique than you know, massive power.
I remember when we went out there, the first thing was trying to get up on the board for one. And then, using that paddle stroke and it's the technique, not the... You can be as fast and as just dig in as much as you want, but it's you're going to get tired really quickly.
Oh yeah,
until you got to build up the technique for sure. You don't need to be super duper strong to. And you look at kids. Kids stand up paddleboard.
Absolutely, yeah. Just need balance.
Yeah, that's the big thing. Paddleboarding is only for flat water.
I always still laugh when I see people doing white water.
Paddleboards can be used in a variety of conditions, including some surf and moving water. Now, the surf...
Makes sense.
It does.
It's intuitive.
The surf was the whole, well, what's the difference between a paddleboard
and
a
surfer?
You're just a surfer with
a stick.
A paddle. Yeah, with a stick. Yeah. You're a surfer with a stick. we have seen, these guys going down white water.
It's like, wow.
And see, the thing
is... so dangerous.
If you're in... And I don't know how much safety gear I've ever seen them wear either.
No. Like,
they got minimal safety gear. I would rather be in that white water and flip in a kayak.
Yeah.
Because you're closer to the water already. And if you've got the helmet and all that. So you're going to hit something. You're, you know, 3 feet between your helmet hitting the water and hitting the rock.
Instead of six.
As opposed to if you're standing, that's 6 feet between your head and that rock.
That's a long way to go.
That's a long way. And who knows what else you're going to hit with different parts of your body on the way down.
And I think back to, again, I'm very much a beginner center paddleboarder. And I think I find it so hard to, the balance thing. I haven't nailed it yet. And then I think to myself, I can't even imagine trying to navigate white water and get around rocks and do technical stuff and eddy out. And it's like, wow.
I wonder how good how easy the transition between stand-up paddleboarding in white water and surfing would be.
Oh, yeah.
Because you got that balance thing,
different
right?
Different technique.
Different technique, but the balance part.
Yeah.
I wonder how easy... the balance change would be between the two.
With surfing, you're kind of curving with the waves. You're turning and you're using momentum and you're using balance in a different way. Whereas with whitewater, you've got waters pulling. You would surfing too, but every which way is like you got turns and you got rocks to avoid. And, and it's like, oh, I got to eddy out here. It's like, yeah, there's the technique is completely different.
But the stand-up paddleboarders that are doing the big surf.
Mm, yep.
You got to think that it definitely helps.
Yes.
Right? So, anyway, just things that go through my brain. Canoeing. Myth. Standing in a canoe is dangerous.
Well, it depends.
I know some goobers. Truth. Experienced canoeists stand for better visibility and maneuverability, especially in rapids. Yeah, you know what? Your butt doesn't have to be on the seat the entire time.
No.
You know, you don't just stand up and start walking around your boat.
Mm-hmm.
My old boat was stable enough. I used to fly fish out of it.
Oh, yeah.
I would stand and fly fish out of it. Hmm. And then got into the stand-up, the poling, the canoe poling, which is all standing. When we see something, if we're in a windy river... And, you know, you're like, well, how much longer till we're out of this, you know, big weed bed? And then you stand up and you can see over top of the, you know, all the tall weeds and stuff like that. And go, oh, yeah, we're heading over there. We can see the mouth of the river. Or sometimes what we'll do is we know there's moose in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be paddling these rivers, windy rivers, and every so often stand up so you could see over everything. Over the
grass.
So you could see, oh, yeah, there's a moose up there. Let's be quiet. Let's go and be prepared to stop because there's a moose or something there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Like, I can hear the waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stand up so you can see over things. Yeah, we're not too far. Keep an eye out for the portage sign.
Oh, you're looking to see, is this water just tipping downhill or is that a drop-off?
Is it a drop? Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, standing, like I say, you got to be careful still.
Yeah.
Don't just, you know, all stand up all willing. I hate being the person in the front of the canoe.
Yeah.
When somebody in back stands up all willy-nilly, not paying attention. Oh, I'm all sturdy. Yeah, well, the front people aren't because they can't see what you're doing. Yeah,
exactly. Right? It's like having a dog in the boat. It's like, hey, what's that dog doing?
Right? So, yeah, you know what? You can stand up in the boat, just give it. Again, that's a skill you learn.
Absolutely.
Right? The myth, all canoeists drink heavily. Truth, while some canoeists enjoy alcohol, it's not a universal trait and it's not essential for the activity.
I think that was thrown in just for fun.
I'm thinking. But there's a lot of people and they go hand in hand being on. What's the thing they always said about water on the water, beer on the pier?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That used to be the thing. And I still to this day, just out of my brain, it's like, I'm not drinking and then going paddling.
No.
I'd never have a drink in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of people. You know what? That's your own your own tickety-boo.
I think it's very dangerous.
I think it is. I won't partake in that. If you want to have a drink while you're...
Mm-hmm.
That's your issue, not mine. I'm not going to be a gatekeeper that say you got to do this, that, the other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. We always would do the at the end of the day when we start making dinner, we're done for the day. You going out on the water anymore? Nope, done for the day. Bar's open.
Mm-hmm.
If we were,
yeah,
and it's not to get hammered.
No, never.
You know, have a couple of sips of something, enjoy your around the campfire or something, and call it a day. Kayaking myth: rolling a kayak is an easy skill to master.
No, it's not.
Truth. Bullsh. Rolling requires practice, patience, and proper technique. Yeah, my technique just doesn't exist. That's definitely something. And everybody says if you're kayaking, you should learn to roll.
It would be nice. It can save you a lot of hassle, and it saves you from swimming. And if you can just pop back up, and whether you're sea kayaking or whitewater kayaking, like, it saves a lot of trouble and hassle. If you can just pop back up and keep going, then it saves a lot of trouble, right?
But mastering the wet exit, my friend. that's something that just doesn't get enough credit.
Exactly. Canoe or kayak.
Right?
Because you wonder, it's like, can I actually get out of this? My feet are really jammed under the seat in this canoe.
Right.
If I flip, am I going to be able to escape this sucker? Or am
That's
I
always
be?
Been my thing.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's amazing. Like, I've never been trapped. That's some people I think.
I've never tipped.
I've tipped.
In all my 35 plus years of canoeing, I've never capsized.
I've never capsized on flat water, but I've done it lots in white water.
Not me?
Lots.
Not me? So far.
Yep, but so far.
I still got another 50 years to go. myth, there's only one way to roll a kayak. Left or right? truth, there are many different roll techniques, and a good instructor will help you find one that best suits your body and skills. The non-roll fits my body and skills perfectly. You know what? And that's the thing is there's more than one technique for many things when it comes to paddling.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. I find that a lot of people, no, this is the way to do it. This is the way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And you really have to get out of that mindset because there is more than one way.
And what works for you.
Exactly. You know, we don't all portage the exact same way. Nope. We don't all hang our food the exact same way if we're in the backcountry. We don't all necessarily paddle the same way, hold a paddle the same way. So what's you're not going to be rolling the same way necessarily. Yeah. Try different ones, because if you can't master that one technique, you're going to give up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So find something. And if you're being coached by somebody, as they say, a good instructor will help you find one that best suits your body and your skills. And you got to be comfortable doing the role. Mm-hmm. I hate being in the under the water. I hate being in the water. I'd like to be on the water.
Yeah.
Oh, so being upside down in a kayak is definitely way beyond what I'm enjoying.
But some people do it like whitewater kayakers. They can just do it just because it's fun.
Losers. You know what those people are? Wrong.
Or that maybe they're just looking for fish. Hey, is there a fish down there?
That's how they live, No, seriously. I mean, I joke, right? But no, if you enjoy doing it, then find one that works for you. And on hot days, I know there's people that go out there and they're like, oh my God, I'm just dying here. And then rolling down, rolling back. They'll roll down, they'll roll back up the same way, or they'll do a complete circle, or, you know, they'll start getting fancy and they'll roll upside down, pass their paddle from one hand to the other hand sort of thing. Or, you know, I've seen people do it with, we've seen the commercials in the beer.
Yes.
Dude flips with a beer in his hand.
Hands it from one hand to the other. Keeps
it upside, hands it from the other side. You know, and then rolls back up the other way so this doesn't spill his beer. That's skill. That is skill. I'll give you that. So, but yeah, find something that, suits you, and there's many ways to do it. General paddling skills. The myth. Paddling is only a recreational activity.
Say what?
Hogwash. Truth is, paddling can be a great form of exercise, a way to explore nature, and a competitive sport.
Mm-hmm.
Not just a recreational...
No.
We're at the cottage, I'm going to take the canoe out. For fishing, for there's so many things to do in a canoe. Or a kayak, or a stand-up paddleboard, or a raft, right? Myth, you can't camp from a kayak or canoe.
Wait, what? I didn't read this one.
Hogwash. Truth, with proper gear and planning, you can absolutely camp from a kayak or a canoe, or a stand-up paddleboard, or a raft. Have you never seen the big rafts going down the Grand Canyon filled with camping gear?
Yeah.
Because you're not making down the Grand Canyon in a day unless you've done something totally
wrong.
Is
the question you can't camp actually physically on the kayak or canoe? Or is it just can't use it as a tool for camping?
You can't camp from a kayak or canoe. So you can't take a canoe or a kayak, load it with camping gear, and go camping.
Yeah. I think that's, I don't know how that's a myth, because that just seems silly.
I think that's just something. I wonder if they're
saying you can't use the kayak or canoe as your camping platform. And I've seen people do that too.
Well, the I wouldn't consider a kayak.
I wouldn't do it, but I've seen,
I've slept in a canoe overnight.
Have you?
Yeah. Yeah, on Bice Lake.
Oh, yeah?
Put a rock on the end of ropes on both ends.
Yeah.
Just offshore and slept in. It was a really nice flat glass lake that night. But I just laid in the bottom of the canoe and had a nice comfortable snooze.
When you roll over, you get wet, but hey.
If you roll over far enough. But I mean, I don't sleep so soundly that, you know, so when I sort of rolling over, I'm awake.
Yeah. You notice.
And this is hard. I'm in the boat. So I got to do it slowly. Yeah. And there's the gunnels, and there's the thwart, and there, you know, that sort of thing. Oh, you know, just got to be careful when you're doing that sort of thing. But, yeah.
Didn't Pierre Elliott Trudeau have some sort of saying about sex in a canoe or something?
I don't know. That was Trudeau. And I know some jokes about American beer. Anyway, so those are some general ones.
Yeah.
Then we get into Cliff Jacobson.
Of course.
Mythbuster.
Yes.
Cliff Jacobson was once asked what prompted him to start writing about canoeing and camping. myths, he said. He was incensed at the many stupid things that were parroted edition after edition in the canoeing literature. And here are some examples, many of which still survive today in modern books. Have you ever used a sea anchor in a canoe?
No.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of...
I've used a drogue on a sailboat. Because it keeps your nose into the wind.
Right.
But not a sea anchor.
A sea anchor.
Not on a
canoe. That slows you down.
Yeah, it would.
Going with the flow in yard-hide waves keeps your attention. Allow the canoe to get off track even momentarily, and it may spin sideways and swamp. Old canoe books recommended the use of a sea anchor to keep the canoe from broaching in the following sea. In a following sea. The legendary canoeing writer Calvin Rutstrom describes the procedure in his book North American Canoe Country, Macmillan Company, 1964. Rutstrom says to tie a 15-foot-long rope to your largest cooking pail when the sea begins to roll too heavily. Throw the pail out into the water behind the canoe. The pail will fill with water, and according to Rutstrom, it will keep the canoe upright and stable and the stern headed into the running sea. Technically, this is a drogue. When deployed off the stern, a sea anchor is deployed off the bow. I tried this once, but the pail snagged on a rock and swamped the canoe. From then on, I preferred proper paddle technique.
There you go.
When running with a heavy sea, the rule is to keep paddling. If you go slower than the waves or turn off wind, the canoe may broach and capsize. The stern person may have to hold a tight rudder to stay the course when the bow paddles ahead. If your canoe begins to surf and a rocky shore looms, get up ahead of steam, then make a well-braced turn, lean downwind into a wave trough. You'll gulp some water and stall sideways in the wave trough. If you goof or lean the wrong way, you'll swim to shore. Once in the trough, turn upwind and ferry ashore. Experienced paddlers who read this will smile. They know it's a surf turn is easier said than done. Better to do it wrong and capsize and save your canoe from crashing at high speed into a rocky shore.
There you go.
So, that's the sea anchor bit. Cliff Jacobson also has something to say about catamaran canoe. Mind you, Cliff Jacobson has a lot to say.
About everything.
About a lot of things.
But he's a very knowledgeable guy.
Yes.
Love that guy.
Catamaran canoes. The idea that two canoes are more seaworthy in a following sea if they are lashed together. Catamaran style. Rutstrom recommends using green cut poles for strength and flexibility. The poles are lashed to the front and stern thwarts, bows about 4 feet apart, sterns about 6 feet apart. The uneven spacing is to keep water from piling up between the poles. It works well enough in moderate wind, but it's a disaster in serious sea. Lashings loosen, poles break, and water splashes in. It's a very wet ride unless you have a spray cover. On the other hand, the late Verlin Kruger had remarkable success with this method, but he had hard-decked canoes, high-strength composite poles, and secure hull fittings. So make sure you know what you're doing, or you're going to be very wet.
Yep.
Quartering waves. Canoeing texts advise you to quarter waves at roughly 30-degree angles when the bow beats upwind. This shortens the canoe's waterline, allows the boat to fit more easily between the oncoming waves. You get better buoyancy and a drier ride. Yes, but, Cliff says.
But.
A canoe, and when I'm reading this, I can hear him saying this too, right?
Mm-hmm.
A canoe on a quartering tack is on the verge of broaching into the wind. It takes a good team to hold the correct angle, especially if the canoe has much rocker. Screw up and you'll swim. A head-on approach to the waves is a safer plan, more so if partners move closer amidships to lighten the ends. Quartering waves is a good plan for skilled paddlers. Beginners are better off to attack oncoming waves head-on. And see, we'll do the a little bit off-center if we need to go not straight into the waves.
Yes.
We'll do a little bit off and then back, forth, and work our way over sort of thing. What is it, tacking?
Yep. Exactly.
Sailboat terms. But, yeah, going so that... Because you're fighting that... If your bow is too far over, you're fighting that constantly, that
you're wallowing
waves trying to...
Yeah, exactly.
Keep pushing that front end over, and yeah, one wrong move and...
Yeah, oh yeah, it'll take
you're
you
away. Swimming.
Yeah.
This one I never got. Push off from shore. I can see why they say to do it, but hogwash.
Yes.
Push off from shore with the grip of your paddle. The plan is to protect the edge of the blade from damage. Well, I'll push off with a foot, thank you, not the polished grip of my $300 carbon fiber paddle. No the doubt. Blade beats the grip if you must push off. Why? Because a rough grip will cause blisters, whereas a nicked blade is a cosmetic nuisance that is easily repaired at home. I present to you my favorite paddle as evidence with a big notch out of the bottom and the perfectly smooth handle.
If you're going to be paddling all day, why are you going to gash that up and scrape your hand and... Even a small wood splinter on the handle or the butt of the handle just drives me nuts.
Right? And if you're using that to hammer in, that's all going to be pinholy and prickly, right? So your hand's going to be in that all the time. And over time, you're going to not just get blistered. You're going to end up with this big wear mark palm from that. It's like, no.
That's not helping anybody out.
No. I can fix a paddle blade if I need to.
Yeah.
If I need to. Go see the evidence once again. and Cliff is on this one as well. Don't stand in a canoe. Baloney. Most experienced open canoe paddlers stand for a better look when they approach rapids. Polars always stand, even when driving up or snubbing down rapids.
There you go.
If you can't stand confidently in a tandem canoe, you probably lack the balance to paddle moving water.
There you go.
Kneel in your canoe when you paddle rapids. Whether you sit or kneel depends on the kind of canoe you have, how it's outfitted, and how you prefer to paddle. Sit and switch, freestyle, etc. Generally, you'll have better control, stronger strokes, and more aggressive leans if you kneel in your canoe. More so if it's outfitted with knee braces and thigh straps. That said, be aware that many canoes, notably narrow lake cruisers and racers, aren't designed for kneeling. The bows are too narrow to place your knees wide for a comfortable stance, and the low seats will trap your feet. Didn't we just have that discussion? Sit low in these canoes and lock your knees against the sidewalls under the inside gunwales. This is a very stable position for running rough water. That's what I tend to do.
I do too, and I like it because it gets my center of gravity down a bit lower.
Yeah.
And you're a bit closer to the water, so you can... It just, I feel it gives you a bit more stability.
Mm-hmm. I've read this one from him before, and I still... Leave a line out. When my wife Susie and I canoed Lewis and Shoshone Lakes in Yellowstone National Park at Ice Out, the ranger who issued our backcountry boat permits told us to trail a 15-foot-long rope behind our solo canoes. The theory being that if we upset in the icy glacial water, we could grab the line and swim the canoe to shore. I told the ranger this was nonsense. He said he wouldn't issue the permit until I agreed to comply. I promised with two fingers crossed.
There you go.
I can see what the guy's getting at, but I don't think I would do that in practice.
I wouldn't. I think it's weird. Like you're risking entanglement, and you're like, if you're going slower than water speed, the line is catching up to you. And I don't know. It's just have a rope that's ready to be pulled off. And that's what I usually do. I have it. I have a light bungee with a hank of cord on the bow and the stern.
Yep.
And I can quickly pull it out and use it.
Right. Right.
I can hop off.
And if you're with somebody else, if you go over, you get to shore. They'll look after your boat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, anyway, so that's Cliff Jacobson's myths. James Raffin had a few from there was a paddling magazine article. After a decade of columns dedicated to history, heritage, esoterica, and minutiae of canoeing, written for paddlers and would-be paddlers, it occurred to me that there might be people out there who are non-paddlers. Maybe the spouses or children of readers who might pick up a copy of the magazine out of curiosity or from self-preservation, having to share living space with a person who goes on and on about all these things canoeing. For the benefit of these folk, here's a debunker's guide to canoe myths, and he's got a few of them here. The first one, canoeists are cheap. Let's get this one right up front when it comes to gear.
My gear's not cheap.
Yeah, I'm talking good gear, not office technical wear. Stuff that's sold with Main Street in mind. Canoeists will spare no expense. It's not so much the availability of funds as it is about the deployment of funds that fuel this myth. Canoeists look at 60s blue porcelain bathroom fixtures, shag carpets, or comely avocado-colored kitchen appliances and ask, why would you want a new one of those when the old ones we have are perfectly serviceable?
Yes. I'm saving my money for a new canoe.
Right? Same goes for decisions about saving for college tuition, weddings versus setting cash aside for a new canoe or a longer, more exotic canoe trip. We're not cheap. We're just saving up.
We are directing our spare cash in a specific direction.
Right? We've had these discussions. Oh, I'll get you a pair of canoeing gloves for Christmas. No, because the canoeing gloves I want, you know, or the whatever. Yeah. Oh, we'll get you this new Coleman burner that screws on top of a green Coleman propane tank.
Oh yeah.
No. For $40. No, the stove I'm looking at is like $300.
Yes.
So don't be buying me that, because your heart's in the right place.
Yes.
But it will never get used.
Exactly.
Right. Canoeists all drink as much as Kevin Callan.
When we mentioned this to Kevin, he's like, what? He hasn't heard this?
I know Kevin Callan is prone to claiming that alcohol taken orally is an excellent bug deterrent. He also claims it makes his skin more water repellent. Whatever other merits he and sidekick Andy Baxter award the perfect bush martini, most canoeists don't drink as much as Kevin. No. For as far back as the Hudson Bay Company and Northwest Company sent voyagers west with casks of whiskey to trade, we've tended to drink more.
Now, I don't know what he's getting at here, but I've spent enough time with Kevin Callan to know that he's not a heavy drinker.
He's not a heavy drinker.
At all.
It's not the fact that most of us drink as much as some of us drink more than. Canoeists with all eventually look like Bill Mason. Bill Mason, big hair, head white of hair, white hair,
disheveled,
big white beard, plaid, in a red canoe, yeah, on the river, dirty, stinky, having a great time.
Kind of looking homeless.
Yeah. A former student came up to me one day and said that he'd just had a strange and portentous dream. In his dream, he was at a talk I was giving. Sitting in the front row, he turned around and everybody in the audience, both men and women, looked just like Bill Mason. The lecture hall was filled with short, white bearded canoeists wearing red flannel shirts and neck scarves. Scary thought.
I know. I'll have to do that. Next time we're at some sort of event for outdoor paddling, just kind of look at the crowd. It's like, oh.
Gotta get a whole bunch of us go to a Kevin Callan event dressed up.
Dressed up like Bill Mason.
Or James Raffin thing. We'll just all dress up like Bill Mason. This one has some truth. However, the Mason-esque characteristic that is echoed by all dyed-in-the-wood wool paddlers is not so much the soggy sneakers, white beard, and plaid shirt. It's the look of their eyes that says, I may be bodily out indoors, but I'm actually running a river in my head.
Yeah.
Full on. Canadian canoeists constantly assert their Canadian-ness.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
That this myth endures is due largely to Pierre Burton or Pierre Elliott Trudeau, neither of whom admitted they said or did anything of the kind. For the record, canoeists are not forever asserting their Canadian-ness in a canoe. We only do so in private. Often in the dark, under pincushioned skies where the water is calm, rarely at put-ins or on portages, and only when overtaken by the wilderness muse. And, safety paramount if on the water, we always take the precaution of removing the center thwart. Canoeists are always right.
That's a good argument.
I'm not going to read any further. Well, anyone who's hung around a canoeist for more than a few minutes will know that no matter what the issue, we all think our solution is the best. This includes such diverse topics as paddling, portaging, how to build a fire, how to make a camp kitchen, how to raise a child, how to foster a relationship, how to achieve world peace and nuclear disarmament, and how to simultaneously eat, drive, and find the access point coordinates on a GPS.
There you go.
I'm going to do all that. Should be able to do that. And if you can't, shame on you.
Yeah.
So those are all the myths.
Yes.
Busting myths. True myths, not so true myths.
A little bit of fun.
A little bit of fun. Some of those are just hogwash, I may say, but I have never personally used a sea anchor or known somebody that's used a sea anchor or a drogue. I don't have time for that crap.
I've done it on sailboats.
Fighting waves to get where I'm going than worry about a... because your brain is split between two things at that point. Your focus is split between going where you're going and this thing dragging behind your boat.
I've thought about doing it and wish I had something I could use as a drogue or a sea anchor, like Hogan Lake. So the wind was going almost perfectly down the lake, and I'm thinking, oh, I could just drop a sea anchor, and I wouldn't go as fast as the wind, but I'd just kind of drag along, and I could fish without having to pay too much attention. But I have used it on a sailboat where if you're out, I've done it out in the middle of a Lake Ontario, you drop the sea anchor out, keeps the bow into the wind, and you can swim off the stern and play in the water. And it was a nice day, but the wind was up a little tiny bit, so it was like having fun.
If I'm going with a tailwind and I want to keep myself straight, I throw up my sail and go like the Dickens. I go as fast as the wind.
Yeah.
That'll take me where I'm going. Anyway.
I actually have a sea anchor at home.
Really?
From when I had a sailboat. So it's still sitting there.
Bet you'd get some good money for it.
Probably.
How big is it?
It's got a good 3-foot opening. It's not something you'd want to take on a canoe. It is not a canoe device. This is for a sailboat.
Not with that attitude, it's not a canoe device. Wow.
Yeah. It's just a... it's the color of a traffic cone, and it's about twice the size of a traffic cone.
So when you fail, they'll see bright orange.
Exactly.
I don't know what the problem is. All right, let's get into something weird. Something. Horror.
Yes.
Horror. If you were told the lake you're about to go paddling on is haunted, would you go?
I would give it a second thought.
And then if people told you why it's haunted,
I would be more curious.
Uh-huh. When Dustin Valencia didn't pick up his kids from school on May 14th, 2025,
very recently,
his wife knew something was wrong. She contacted the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office near their Georgia home, and the search began for the 43-year-old father of five. with the help of the Find My Phone app, investigators found his vehicle a short time later at Little Ridge Park on Lake Lanier. As an avid outdoorsman, it seemed fitting that Valencia had gone kayaking that afternoon. Sadly, he didn't return from the trip alive. According to the statement from the sheriff's office posted online, a resident found Valencia's kayak on May 14th, reported to the sheriff's office the following day. The sheriff's office, county fire, Department of Natural Resources, and the Army Corps of Engineers conducted a search of the area. And the DNR located and Forsyth County Fire recovered a body the afternoon from the lake. No positive identification had been made, and they continued to investigate the incident. And then a few days later, sheriff's office announced it positively identified the body as the missing father. Valencia's death remains under investigation, but the lake where he died has been the subject of local lore for decades. Lake Lanier was formed by flooded communities, including a cemetery. Many believe that it led to a haunting. More than 200 people have died in the lake since 1994. That's 30 years. 200 people in 30 years.
And so they also say that in total, it's over 700 people have died on this lake. And in the last 30, 200 people. So that's a lot of... That's a lot.
And you got to think, well, what's the history of this, right? So right now, I'm thinking when I'm hearing that, yeah, I'm not going paddling on that
lake.
Yeah,
it seems suspicious.
Because, you know, it's going to be 201. I don't want to be the one.
I don't want to be a statistic.
So there's an article when I was doing some research from Oxford Magazine by Anjali and Jetty. A restless energy seized the air March 2020, right after schools began shutting down due to COVID, and a friend and I were hiking Laurel Ridge Trail, 4-mile loop along the southern rim of Lake Sydney Lanier, sprawling amoeba, the man-made lake built in 56 for flood control, drinking water, and hydroelectric power, touches 5 counties in North Georgia.
It's a big lake.
It is named after 19th century Georgian poet Sidney Lanier, whose poem Song of the Chattahoochee is an ode to the river that feeds it. You had some stats on the lake.
Yes, there's... let me pull that up. So, the dog's got to get out. The dog is panicking. I got to go. So, Lake Lanier is located in Georgia. It has more than 690 miles of shoreline. The lake also covers a surface area of approximately 38,000 acres.
Holy crap.
So that's a lot of surface area. It's
right?
When you look at it, if you Google it on Google Maps, the Google Maps draw that black and white dotted line along the edge, and it's like, I can see why they call it an amoeba, because it's just a big splotch.
There are so many coves and inlets and...
And it's all just because it's a dam. It's a headwater. So the, what was the name of the dam? The Bonham? I can't remember what the name, the dam itself. But anyways, it's at one end, and this whole area was flooded. It's similar to...
Buford Dam.
Buford, yeah, the Buford Dam. So it's sort of similar, if anybody's familiar with the Saunders Hydroelectric Dam on the St. Lawrence River. So the Long Sault area has been flooded. And if you know where to go, I used to scuba dive there when I was in college. You could go down and look at scuba dive at old buildings and old structures and whatnot, right? So that's what Lake Lanier is. It's just this whole flooded area with over like 692 miles of shoreline. That's a lot
it's
of shoreline.
Huge.
Yeah.
So this Anjali there, she keeps writing, I had just canceled 2 trips out of town, and my friends, whose father had passed away in England a few weeks earlier, had recently returned from settling his affairs. News about the rapid spread of a virus, coupled with President Trump's rampant disinformation, filled us with anxiety. We longed for an escape, some fresh air, so we jumped in my car, drove 11 miles north to the lake. Western end of the trail runs along Chattahoochee River near Buford Dam, the colossal barrier that birthed the lake. Rains had recently moved through the part of the state, causing extensive flooding, closing several of the local parks as well as pedestrian bridge in front of the dam. Before the dam and the lake came to be, 700 families inhabited the 60 square miles, an hour's drive north of Atlanta. Farms, forests, homes, churches, mills, businesses, and cemeteries covered the area. Preparation for the lake, the U.S. government forced residents off the land that had been their families for generations. Army Corps of Engineers then relocated most of the structures. If the Corps couldn't obtain permission from family members, the graves stayed put.
And that's a legal thing. You can't just move the graves.
Yeah. You need permission. All those graves and bodies are still down
there. They're down there.
Roads, bridges, and some trees were also left behind, as was the old Gainesville Speedway. During a severe drought in 2007, the same year she moved to Georgia, the racetrack's concrete stadium seating breached the surface as if it had been dug up in an archaeological excavation. Took a few years, but the lake eventually filled. Today, at its deepest point by the dam, it plummets 200 feet. From the Chattahoochee River, the trail winds back east across Buford Dam Road to the lake's southern lip. As the sun began its rapid descent, the water turned black and murky. This is like how horror movies start. Around the next bend, we spotted a partially submerged steel dock. Was it safe? Despite our reservations, we walked out to the far end to take a few photos, then rushed back to shore. We were lucky. We had tempted fate and survived. Lake Lanier, the largest lake in Georgia, is one of the deadliest in the U.S. Since its formation, 500 people have died there, nearly 200 since 1994. 11 million visitors descend upon the shores every year. 500 out of 11 million.
Yeah.
About the same number that visit the Louvre.
But how many people die at the Louvre?
Right? But the lake's popularity doesn't explain the high number of fatalities. Lake Allatoona, 40 miles to the west, receives close to the same numbers of visitors every year, but has one-third of the deaths. Even still! Don't go to Georgia! Drownings or motor vessel accidents are the usual culprits. There's no upward or downward trend and no way to predict year after year how many victims the reservoir will claim. One explanation for the high number of fatalities lies beneath the surface. Debris and rubble from before the lake's construction, as well as everything from sunken boats to lawn chairs to fishing wire, create a treacherous underwater obstacle course. This, coupled with the lake's low visibility, makes rescue operations dangerous. But there's another theory for the body count. Ooh. Legend has it, Lake Lanier is haunted. Perpetrators vary. Some blame spirits from the graves, the corpse of engineers.
It's fitting in this case.
Right? Never relocated in 1956. Others fault the phantoms of the 27 victims who have died over the years at the lake, but whose bodies were never successfully recovered.
Oh.
Are you warming up your canoe to go already?
The man with the hooked hand.
The most famous ghost story known as Lady of the Lake reigns supreme in these parts. 1958, two friends, Della Mae Parker Young and Susie Roberts, departed a dance. After getting gas and skipping out on paying for it, they skidded off a bridge while crossing the lake and disappeared. Following year, a fisherman came across a decomposed, unidentifiable body floating near one of the bridges. It wasn't until 1990, over three decades later, that officials discovered a 1950 Ford sedan with remains belonging to Roberts, which meant that the body found way back in 1959 must have belonged to her friend Parker Young. Locals don't need a forensic analyst to know this. They had seen Parker Young themselves wearing a blue dress as she had borrowed that night from Roberts, wandering near the bridge with her handless arms, so the story goes. She snatches unsuspected lake goers and drags them to the bottom. I had no idea Lake Lanier was lethal. The last few years I lived in Georgia, I was simply taken in by its beauty. Sunny days, its spectacular thickets of lush green groves, mainly oaks and hickories, encircle sparkling blue water. 160 small islands, hilltops too high for the Corps of Engineers to have submerged, crest above the surface. It is a vibrant and diverse ecosystem, especially on the southern end. Latinx, Asian, and Black visitors fill the surrounding parks. Every summer, our family joins them. We toss towels and flotation devices into the car and head to the crescent beach of Buford Dam Park. Crisp, savory scent of barbecue wafts through the air. Frisbees and picnic baskets blanket the grassy knolls. Geese and ducks waddle among them in search of leftovers. The swimming hole, far from any boating area, is calm. The sand underfoot soft. Yeah, knowing what I'm knowing, I'm not going swimming.
Exactly.
Because I'm just hearing, doo-doo, doo-doo. Dun, 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 dun. It had a hook hand. My three daughters have spent hours splashing in the clear, shallow water trying to catch fish that encircled their feet. When they were little, they'd build towers and plastic buckets and write their names with sticks on the shore. We'd stay as long as we could until our skin withered and pruned, until the last handful of grapes was consumed and the sun gave way to the moon. You don't want to be out there in haunted waters under the moon?
No, no,
come
no.
Come on,
worst
people.
Time. Worst time.
My naivete about Lake Lanier's dangers ended abruptly in 2012 when 11-year-old Kyle Glover, the stepson of R&B singer Usher, died from injuries he suffered when a jet ski collided with his inner tube. After the horrific incident, I began taking a hard look into the other deaths, the dozens of collisions, the drownings of swimmers who disappeared after jumping in, the divers who rode their vehicles into the lake. Our family does not boat, jet ski, or tube at Lake Lanier. We've never even visited the lake's water park. Our radius extends only to designated swimming areas or trails. Like the haunted people are going to pay attention. Oh, that's like the monster. Oh, his foot is in the blanket. I can't grab his foot.
He's out of our jurisdiction.
Right? Still, when I learned how many people had died, it was difficult for me to reconcile what seemed like such a serene place with so much tragedy. Lake Lanier's tragic history can be traced back long before it became a lake. Forsyth County, which sits on the western side, was once part of the Cherokee Nation. In the 1830s, the U.S. government expulsed most of its members from what could be one of the southeasternmost origins of the Trail of Tears. Second expulsion occurred 80 years later, this time involving a different community. Up until 1912, some 1,100 black people owned land and operated businesses in Forsyth County. That fall, an 18-year-old white woman named May Crow was raped and murdered in the village called Oscarville. Crimes were pinned on four young black people who happened to live nearby. They were Ernest Knox, Oscar Daniel, Trussie Jane Daniel, and Robert Big Bob Edwards. Day after Edwards' arrest, a white mob invaded his jail cell. He was shot, dragged through the streets, and hanged from a telephone pole just outside the courtroom in Cumming, the county seat. Crow's death and Edwards' lynching begat more violence. White mobs went door to door with torches and guns, burning down black churches and businesses, demanding that all black residents in Forsyth County vacate immediately. The residents quickly abandoned their land, their crop, their homes, and most of their belongings. In October, a jury took a little over an hour to convict Ernest Knox and Oscar Daniel for Crow's killing. 5,000 people gathered to watch the two teenage boys be hanged. It is widely believed that Edwards, Knox, and Daniel were innocent of the crime.
Yeah. Group mentality.
While Lake Lanier was formed in the 50s, it washed over Oscarville and turned it into an underwater ghost town.
Mm-hmm.
It is the storied past, beginning with the Cherokee removal, to the banishment of black people in Forsyth County, to the lake's disembodied souls in search of some kind of absolution that I carry with me whenever I visit. A few weeks after my trip to Laurel Ridge Trail, like the rest of the U.S., Georgia began shutting down. With most restaurants and stores closed, Georgians flocked to state parks. Governor refused to mandate masks, so few visitors bothered to wear them. Though I longed for another trip to Lake Lanier, the thought of crowds kept me away.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mid-June, we woke to unseasonably cool weather. Sky was uninspiring steel gray. We decided to take our chances. Late in the afternoon, we packed a cooler full of food and water. Expectations were low. If the beach was too crowded, we turned right around and come home. When we arrived, only a few other vehicles idled in the parking lot. The beach was practically empty. We made a beeline to the far end and had a 50-foot stretch to ourselves. See, and this is when the ghosts are going to strike.
You don't have that group protection.
Right? Well, there's only these people here. Guess we're not beggars can't be choosers. Look at them, boys.
Ghosts don't attack crowds.
The girls grabbed our inner tubes and noodles and leapt into the water. I settled into a big chair, dug my toes into the cool sand, watched them act like the teens and preteens they were for the first time since the pandemic started. A light breeze tickled my shoulder. Was it merely a breeze or the lady of the lake? And what of the celestial beings lingering near their graves buried deep under the water? Though I have never been one to believe in ghosts, I've always believed in stories. We will hug the beach and the gentle waters that lap it, but we will never cross the rope boundary of the swimming area, the belly of the reservoir, with its deep dark waters and all of its mysteries and secrets. We will leave to the dead. They are the rightful occupants after all. Dun, dun, dun.
I found a lake depth chart for the lake.
I would not go on that lake. I don't think I'd even visit the lake.
I think I would. I'm looking
at it. There are so many points where horror movies, if you don't watch horror movies, you should start watching, because there are so many things in this story that tell you bad things are going to happen.
Nothing good can come of this.
Nothing good. So, this is how I die. Well, I thought that was, like I say, with all the boat activity and everything on there, and all the history.
Yeah.
Would you, if you knew a lake was haunted, there was all these stories and unexplained things. Would you still go out on the lake?
The thing is, regardless of believing in hauntings and ghosts, regardless of all that, there's still statistically the fact that quite a few people die on these waters. Well, was it about a month ago, a month and a day, or a month and a couple days ago, there was another accident there. And did anybody die in that incident? 7 people were injured.
Yeah, they're just everybody was injured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's sitting there. Everybody's enjoying the day. And all of a sudden, boom, somebody's boats explodes.
Yeah. Near Margaritaville.
Margaritaville. Yeah. Unexplained. Just all of a sudden.
Another one.
Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, kablam.
Another statistic for the pile.
Right?
Hmm.
So you say depth chart?
Yes, I found a depth chart. It's kind of cool. But if you look at, if you just Google like Lanier depth chart, and it comes up, and you can see.
Shows you where all the fish are.
Yeah, but it shows you the original path of the original river.
Mm-hmm.
And it also shows you, like, do you know how you look at Grand Canyon or wherever, and you can see, you know, over millions of years, all of these arms of the Grand Canyon are all eroded away by flowing water. So you can imagine that all of these areas were flowing water that washed out these little short valleys and whatever, and they all became part of Lake Lanier. And the depth charts show you, well, I don't know, like I like depth charts for lakes because it gives you an idea where to fish. But this one here might be something to help you find bodies.
Yeah, I'm not going there. Hey, you want to go on a canoe trip? Where? Lake Lanier. See ya!
I just occurred to me that I'm busy.
Am I in your
will? I haven't gave you a date yet. Well, I'm still busy.
I'm still getting my hair cut.
Sean, you're bald. I'm getting my hair cut. Don't question it.
Don't question it. I'm getting hair painted on. Yeah, I just saw that. I came across that. I'm thinking, the United States' most haunted lake.
Mm-hmm.
I would not go paddling there. There's just too many indicators.
No, there's warning flags.
Whether you believe in it or not, there's just too many red flags on there.
Yeah, 100%.
Not doing it.
Zoinks.
All right. Well, that's all I got.
I'm sure Scooby-Doo would have fun there.
Oh, Scooby Gang? Oh, yeah. They're Shaggy and Scooby. Yeah, they definitely have a blast there.
Those pesky kids.
Yeah. It wasn't for them kids and that dog. We would have gotten away with this for another 200 years.
Exactly.
All righty. You got anything else?
I have nothing to add.
All right. Well, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or you can go to the download our and stream our episodes at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or just go to the episode page at Paddling Adventures Radio and stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.